New.
I believe the word is new.
Find out what's new.
Welcome to New, the podcast of New Scientist magazine. I'm Bill Oxley. This week on New, can a robot think like you and me? Will the internet expose thousands of anonymous sperm donors? Did the invention of gunpowder really spring out of a dung heap? We'll answer those questions and a lot more over the next 10 minutes. So join us as we bring you the latest news in science and technology as gathered by the editors and staff of New Scientist. And while we're at it, we'll give you a chance to win a Bose SoundDock if you enter our weekly quiz. And now, on with the podcast. Here's Jeff Davis.
By using a swab of his own saliva, an online genealogical service, and the internet, a 15-year-old boy was able to do what's never been done before. He's tracked down his genetic father, despite the fact that his father was an anonymous sperm donor. The case is an unexpected result of a new kind of biotechnology that's now available over the internet. New Scientist reporter Allison Motlick explains.
This is a service that's primarily for people who want to know more about their family background or their family tree. Maybe they want to sketch in some distant branches of the family tree. So they hand in their DNA, it's analyzed, and this service can say, here are some other people who share some markers with you, and we can predict how related they are to you, and then you can compare your family trees and see if you fit in together.
But while most people who use the service are interested in the distant roots of their family tree, the boy in the case, whose name has not been released, was looking for someone much closer to home, and he found him thanks to the Y chromosome. The Y chromosome is unique because it's passed from father to son, virtually unchanged, just like a surname. So the pattern of gene variants the Y chromosome carries can help identify which paternal line an individual's descended from. And it exposes the genetic links between related males, whether they have the same surname or not. In this case, the result of the boy's DNA tests show that his Y chromosome closely matched that of two other clients of the online service. The two did not know each other, but the genetic similarity meant that they and the boy had a better than 50% chance of sharing a father, grandfather, or great-grandfather. Importantly, the two men have the same last name, which allowed the boy to search the birth records of other men of the same name.
The boy already knew the day and the place where his donor had been born, but the name provided him with a way to really pinpoint the individual. So the boy began to track down his donor just using the internet, and it took him a total of just 10 days, at which point he contacted the donor.
The story has huge implications because it suggests that tens of thousands of people who were conceived using donated sperm could follow this boy's example. In fact, because of online DNA testing, the whole idea of anonymous sperm donation could soon be obsolete. That may be especially upsetting news for men who donated anonymously before the power of genetics was fully appreciated.
Many of these men, when they donated sperm, they didn't really think about the implications, but the implication is that they may have 5, 10, 12 children who are all very interested in meeting them now. And these children, it's only going to get easier. These children are going to be able to track down a lot of these donors. It might be a good idea to start thinking about how to facilitate these meetings between people rather than donors living in fear of being detected and offspring spending years of their lives searching. Perhaps we could start to facilitate some kind of meeting between these people.
And the implications go beyond boys searching for their genetic fathers. It's also possible that police could perform similar searches with DNA from a crime scene, which could identify a criminal by surname.
From the Boston office of New Scientist, here's Ivan Semenek.
On November 5th, 1605, the infamous conspirator Guy Fawkes was captured under the Houses of Parliament with 1,800 pounds of gunpowder. The powder was meant to assassinate the King of England and take out as much of the government as possible, thereby precipitating a revolution. As history records, the Big Bang never happened. Fawkes was captured and executed, and the gunpowder was probably too wet to do the kind of damage he and his co-conspirators had in mind. Nevertheless, people in Britain have been celebrating the foiling of the plot ever since. And this year, being the 400th anniversary, New Scientist contributor Mick Hamer decided to take a closer look at the volatile substance that lies at the center of this story, namely gunpowder itself. Hi, Mick. Welcome to our podcast.
Hello, Ivan.
So, Mick, what is gunpowder exactly, chemically speaking?
Right. Well, it's a mixture of three things. There's saltpeter, which is basically potassium nitrate. There's sulfur, and there's charcoal, the stuff that you use to fire your barbecues with.
Now, charcoal and sulfur, to me, seem like fairly easy resources, even in Guy Fawkes' time 400 years ago, that you could lay your hands on these things. What about saltpeter, this critical ingredient? Where did it come from?
In medieval Europe, it was much more of a problem. What you basically had to do was to build a compost heap with lots of wood in it to make sure that you got plenty of air into it, and mix the compost with the right sort of dung. I mean, basically cow manure, horse manure, something like that, and keep it nice and wet. After a while, when you had it for several months, I mean, this is a process that took probably 2 years or something like that, you started to get a bit of a white incrustation on the top of your compost heap. So you scrape off this white incrustation, dissolve it in water, purify it a bit, and at the end of it, after repeating this process hundreds and hundreds of times, you get a small amount of saltpeter.
So if I'm understanding correctly, without a lot of dung, you cannot have that little bit of gunpowder.
That's right. You need dung, you need compost, you need organic stuff decaying, and you basically get a bit of potassium nitrate out of it. You then have to purify it, which is no simple process at all.
Well, Mick, thank you for your efforts in bringing this barnyard chemistry to our attention.
Right. There you go.
Now it's time for Sound Bites, our weekly contest. Each week, we'll provide you a mystery quote from a recent science or technology story, along with a clue and a question. Your job is to guess the one-word answer to the question. Guess the answer, and you'll be eligible for our grand prize. Now get ready. Here's this week's sound bite. If an intelligent designer used his skill, cunning, and craft to make all these things, the fact that most of them go extinct is an embarrassment. That was the quote. This week's clue is testimony. And the question we want you to answer is this. In what city did the witness speak? Once again, in what city did the witness speak? If you think you know the answer, just visit www.newscientist.com/podcast and click on the competition link. If you get the right answer, you'll automatically be entered in our grand prize drawing to win one of five Bose sound docs. Good luck.
It's been 13 billion years in the making. Now it's here. NewScientistSpace.com is a new website from New Scientist dedicated to bringing you stories from the edge of the universe and beyond. If you're looking for stories from the worlds of astronomy and space exploration, visit NewScientistSpace.com today and be prepared to be amazed.
And now it's time for this week's cover story. Here's Donna Page.
A strange-looking robot is moving around the room. It's shaped like a trash can, but its behavior seems uncannily human. The robot picks up blocks in its metal jaws, and it appears to be choosing among them. Within a half an hour of being switched on, the robot has already learned which blocks it prefers. This is Darwin 7, and as science writer Douglas Fox tells us, it represents a very different approach to artificial intelligence.
Darwin 7 starts out with a blank brain, but just like a baby, it's actually driven by a few basic, very human-like instincts to explore its world and learn. Instincts like an interest in bright objects, a tendency to grab and taste bright objects, and an innate idea of what actually tastes good and what tastes bad. And by good, it's actually tasting whether blocks conduct electricity, and if they do conduct electricity, that's a good taste, and if they don't conduct electricity, that is a bad taste.
Darwin 7 is a creation of the Neurosciences Institute in La Jolla, California. It was built to test neuroscientists' theories of how real brains work. And if they're right, it could be an ancestor of a new generation of intelligent machines. Machines that learn from their experiences just like human babies do.
Darwin is really quirky. Every time you start it up with a blank brain, and the scientists at NSI have done this many times, its habits and its behaviors turn out just a little bit different. And it also makes mistakes, just like real people. Sometimes it grabs a block that it shouldn't have grabbed, a block that would taste bad. But just like with humans, it actually learns with the mistakes and actually often discovers something that is worth knowing.
The key to Darwin's abilities lie in its brain. Although it's run by a computer, the robot's behavior is not hardwired. Instead, the computer is made of some 200,000 individual neural units, divided into 18 functional areas. This includes a visual area that detects edges and a motor area that detects movement. It also includes a virtual pleasure center that simulates a release of neurotransmitters when the robot picks up a particularly tasty block. But what's really interesting about Darwin is that its neurons are connected in a way that simulates what scientists have measured when they look at the activity of rat and ape brains in the lab. In a sense, Darwin was not built to imitate the way living things behave, but to imitate the way they think. The behavior arises naturally.
In both artificial neural networks and in brains, structure, that is the connectivity between the neurons, is what really gives rise to the functional ability of it. We already have neural networks, artificial networks that can recognize faces, detect credit card fraud, that sort of thing. And they do quite good jobs, but they're really very specialized. You might say that they're actually doing kind of a tiny fragment of an intelligent act, only a really small corner of what a whole brain would be doing. The thing that's different with Darwin is you have all these pieces put together. You actually have You have the ability to see, you have the intake of multiple senses, you have the ability to move and bump around, and it's only when you have all these things put together that the sum really equals more than the parts, and that's where intelligence arises.
Of course, this is just the beginning. The dream is that this new kind of electronic brain, embedded in a body of silicon and steel, will achieve a level beyond today's artificially intelligent systems and acquire what no existing robot has achieved, something we humans call common sense.
Well, that's it for our podcast, but it's just the beginning of what you can find in the November 5th issue of New Scientist magazine. Also in this week's edition, Monkeynomics. It seems that monkeys make economic decisions as wisely as we do. What's more, studying the way our primate cousins behave could help us manage our finances even more effectively. And on the other hand, one scientist thinks we're looking at handedness the wrong way. Rather than classifying ourselves as right-handed or left, he thinks it's more like strong-handed or mixed. All this plus more news, features, and opinion. Remember, only New Scientist brings you the week's best ideas. I'm Bill Oxley. Additional voices this week, Donna Page and Jeff Davis. Join us next week and find out what's new in science and technology.
Mission control. Transmission concluded.